Well, George probably didn't tell you that my watch, I've got a special watch. It runs real slow. So 45 minutes is going to be about 3 hours. Hope he didn't drink a lot of coffee. All right. My topic this morning, the first message, is called The Introduction to Paganism. And it will be an introduction. You know, in just a very brief momentary thought here for introduction, paganism is really probably the most serious issue that we face. It's really the issue behind all issues. And we have, at least most of us, have some very shallow understandings of what paganism is and how it affects us. And because of that, we're not prepared. So with that, let's get started. A lot of the Bible verses I'm going to be dealing with, I'm just going to read them or quote them. You don't bother trying to look up every verse I call out. You'll get too tired. But let's start this morning with Jeremiah chapter 10, verse 2. And there we read, "Learn not the way of the heathen." Now, why would the Lord say, "Learn not the way of the heathen"? Well, very obvious. You learn the way of the heathen, and you will not be faithful to me. Our whole life should be focused on being faithful to the Lord Jesus. If we are not faithful to the Lord Jesus, it's ugly. Now, this warning against the influence of the heathen is regarding numerous practices. I'm not even going to go to the verses. If you want to go into this later and look these all up yourself, go ahead. There's probably about 250 verses in the Old Testament alone that touch on the practices of the heathen in a very general way or in a very specific way. And some of them that they go into in the Old Testament and New Testament, they were filled with sexual sin, fornication, incest, adultery, homosexuality, bestiality, just things that we shudder to even think. It's hard, it's painful to let the word roll off our tongue. There is idolatry. Not just the classic idolatry, which is the worship of a statue made out of gold or silver. There was the worship of the planets and the sun and the moon and the stars and the forces of nature. They worshiped the storm. They worshiped the earthquake. They worshiped the tornadoes. They worshiped the forces of nature. They sacrificed their children to the gods. Now, sometimes they just passed their children through the fire in a figurative way. But sometimes they literally sacrificed their children in fire. And then they had some things that just seemed like, why would God be so worried about that? That's a small point. We're going to look into some of these. They were the Jews were warned, don't trim your corners of your beards like the heathen. Men weren't supposed to wear earrings. They weren't supposed to have tattoos. They weren't supposed to tattoo their body. They weren't supposed to mix woolen and linen. Some of these things seem like, what's the issue with that? Well, there was an issue. We will get into that. So we have this whole list of things, all these points, that the Jews were not supposed to learn those ways. Learn not the way of the heathen. Some of these points seem so far removed from our experience that you might be thinking, well, you know, other than maybe tattoos and men wearing earrings, we don't really have paganism going on in our day, and not in America. But the fact of the matter is, we do. We live in a pagan culture. If you don't see that walking in the streets of any town in modern America, you are just as much in paganism as if you were walking down a dirt path in a jungle village in South America with raw paganism of the tribal version. If you can't see that these are the exact same thing, just that we got sophisticated paganism and they got uncultured, unsophisticated paganism, if you can't see they're the same thing, you need to go back to the Scriptures and get the mind of the living God, because they are the same thing. What this brings us down to is paganism is not a matter of history. Paganism isn't something that historians pull their dusty volumes off the shelf and they start studying history and, oh, the pagans used to believe this and the heathen used to believe that and this is the way the pagans used to be and, oh, I just love studying history. No, this is not a matter of history. It's a matter for present watching and praying. It's a matter of present spiritual warfare. Every expression of paganism that I just was talking about, these things are all still here. 100% of paganism. Every essential expression of paganism that was in the world 4,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, 1,000 years ago, it is still here today in America. The reason that we don't recognize paganism is we have a superficial conception of paganism. We're focused on a few of the more ugly expressions of paganism. Now, people of discernment, if you're in a Bible-believing evangelical circles and you hear paganism, you might see that, oh yeah, this ungodly tattoo culture and this really nasty rock and roll subcultures, it just seems pagan to me, and you can see that. And maybe if some of you have read something like The Two Babylons by Alexander Hislop, you understand that Roman Catholicism is just taking paganism and putting a little Christian paint on it. But the fact of the matter is, that's just 1 or 2% of paganism. America is pagan. And right here we have a fundamental problem. Of the five principles of warfare, one of them is know your enemy. You don't know your enemy, you cannot fight your enemy. You know what the flip side of that is? You have to know your own strengths and weaknesses. You have to know the strengths and weaknesses of your own military capacities. If you overestimate your abilities, you're going to lose. If you don't know your enemy, you cannot win. You don't know the terrain you fight in. You're at tremendous disadvantage. We need wisdom. We need discernment. And we need to understand this issue. So the first thing I want to point out for you to understand what we're talking about paganism or the heathenism is, let's start with this. The Hebrew word translated heathen in Jeremiah 10:2, learn not the way of the heathen, is goyim. Goyim is the plural. Goy is the singular. In the Hebrew, the I am at the end of the word makes it plural. This word is translated nation or nations 373 times. It's translated Gentiles 30 times. Translated people or peoples 11 times. It's translated heathen or heathens 142 times. The New Testament word is ethnos or ethne. It's translated nations 64 times, Gentiles 93 times, heathens 5 times, peoples 2 times, and Greek 1 time. Now, I don't bring this out so that we can say, oh, you know, maybe we've just been too negative on heathenism and paganism. If the heathenism and paganism, if that just means the nations, well, whew, yeah, that's not so bad. No, really, this needs to be going the other way. When we hear nations are Gentiles, we should shudder just like when we hear pagan or heathen. The problem is that we don't have a deep enough understanding, a full enough understanding of how dark the nations are the peoples of this world. So I'm not trying to put paganism in less of a negative light. I'm trying to get us to see world, nations, Gentiles in a more negative light. This whole world is in the living rebellion against the living God. What you need to do is in your thinking, in your discernment, take the content, that negative content that rattles around in your mind and your heart when you hear the word heathen or hear the word pagan, take that content and consciously, intelligently, purposely put it into Gentiles and nations and peoples. So that when you hear a verse or read a verse that talks about the nations, you have that negative sense, that nuance, paganism or heathenism. If you do that, you're going to read the Bible in a little bit different light. Many a passage. Now, we have a skewed view of paganism. We inherited a skewed view of paganism. Culturally, we, from the Greeks and the Romans, we inherited a view of paganism which, from the Greeks. The Greeks weren't pagans. The cultured Greeks were not pagans. Everybody else was pagans. They were the heathen. With the Romans said, the Romans and the Greeks are not pagans. Everybody else is pagan. Well, the fact of the matter is the Greeks and the Romans were pagans. They were heathens. They were idolaters. They did not have Judeo-Christian morality. And so we have a very similar perception of paganism or heathenism if we're raised in the American church or European churches. You know, we'll look at the Canaanites and the Philistites, the Amorites in the Old Testament with their bloody idolatry and their immorality, and we'll shudder because that looks like paganism or heathenism to us. And we read about the Incas and the Aztecs and the Mayans and their sacrificing children and their jungle religion and their tribal religion, we shudder a little bit because that looks like paganism to us. And especially now we hear about jungle tribes and witch doctors and voodoos and stuff. Now we definitely know we're in heathen or pagan territory. And maybe the more discerning will realize that, you know, in India with the Hinduism and 10,000 gods and there's idols and sacrifices and incense and stuff that we're dealing with paganism or heathenism. But basically when we're doing this, we're regarding cultures that are widely disparate or separate from our Western culture, our cultured Western culture. That's what heathenism is, you know. So the Western society, the civilized Western society in America and Europe and Canada and Australia, we're not heathen or pagan societies. It's these jungle witch doctors and the ancient infant sacrifice. That's paganism. It's not so. And because we think this way, then when we're thinking about paganism creeping into the church, we're thinking about these young, brash, rebellious teenagers that want to grow, the boys want to grow their hair really long and the girls want to cut their hair short and their tattoos all over the place and their faces pierced. They look like someone missed a duck and hit them when they're out hunting. And they listen to music that just makes a believer shudder, even if it's got, quote, Christian words to it. And so when we see that stuff now, that's departing from Western culture. So that's paganism. Well, that is paganism. And it is a problem. It is a threat to the spiritual integrity and the spiritual health of the church. But if that's all that we're looking at when we're thinking of paganism, we're going to miss the boat. We're going to plug 3 holes in the bottom of the boat and we're going to leave 6 that aren't plugged and we're still going to sink. Basically, what you do here is you give a failing grade to uncultured paganism, and you take Western cultured paganism and it gets a pass. It's not bad. I mean, maybe not really good, but it's not bad. But it is a problem. And because it's a problem that we're not dealing with in the Western Evangelical Church, surprise, surprise. Why has the Western Evangelical Church got so much knowledge on paper and so little spirituality in their heart, in their life, in their home, and in their churches? It's because every time cultured paganism holds out the palm branch and wants to make peace, we say, oh, we've been just waiting for this day. We want everything you have to offer. We want the clean world. We just want to take clean worldliness and put a Jesus bumper sticker on it. It It would be funny if it isn't so sad. The fact of the matter is, the whole world is paganized. You don't go to the jungle. You don't go to the inner city to see paganism. You don't go to the Catholic Church to see paganism. If you can't walk into your typical evangelical church and see paganism, you don't have a clue what paganism is. If you can't walk into your typical corporate environment in America and not see paganism, you have no idea what paganism is. If you can't turn the television on and not be see rivers of paganism streaming at you, you have no idea what paganism is. In Revelation 17:2 and 18:3, we read, "All the nations have drunk of the wine of the heat of her fornication." It's referring to Babylon. There is not a nation on earth. There is not a political country nation. There is not a people nation. There is not a kingdom. There is not a society. There is not a tribe. There is not a state. There is not a town. There is not a county. There is not a church. There is not an institution. There is not a college. There is not a radio or TV station. There is nothing in the world that has not drunk the wine of the heat of the fornication of Babylon. The whole world is drunk on it. The whole world. The entire religious realm. The entire political realm. The entire economic and financial realm. The whole world is drunk on Babylonian wine. This is a historic fact. It's not just something that just quickly develops in the last decade or two of history where the world goes from non-Babylonian pollution to Babylonian pollution. Babylonian pollution has been in the world since the Tower of Babel. That problem arose in the world where the world was going to make a name for themselves. They were living for pride and for pleasure. And the world got together and they built themselves that tower. And God said, "We have a problem." And He stopped the whole thing. And He divided the peoples. So that now all of a sudden people are speaking different languages and they're all over the place and they're scattered. That slowed down the Babylonian problem. It did not stop it. And since that day, the mystery of iniquity, the mystery of the Babylon problem has been in the world in thousands of forms. And they're starting to come together. The world is starting to be of one mind and one heart and one language and one religion and one political purpose and one economic system. It's headed this way. And it's not just headed this way. It's going to get there. There are long ways towards success. The implication is the same wicked, idolatrous Babylonian spirit that's in the Old Testament that we see when people are doing their idolatrous religions and they're sacrificing their children. That same wicked Babylonian spirit is in our present world. It's in our economic system. It's in our political system. It's in our religious systems. It's the same spirit. It may be cleaned up a little bit. Maybe got a new suit of clothes on. Maybe it's a little more sophisticated. A little more cultured. But it is the same spirit. It's the same thing. Implication. America and Europe. We are just as Babylonian in spirit as the ancient Babylonians or the Canaanites. Sophisticated, cultured Western society is just as pagan as Haitian voodoo and witch doctors. I mean, if we stop and we start thinking about this and we seek God on this and we seek the Scriptures on this kind of light, it's stunning how dark this world really is. Wall Street and big business are just as pagan as the ancient Phoenicians and the ships of Tarshish. Now, just one clarification. They're just as pagan in fact. They're not necessarily just as pagan in degree. Paganism comes in degrees. But it will be, at the end of this age, the whole world is going to be as black can be. It's racing there. Now, what's the essence of paganism? The essence of paganism is heart departure from God. It's not a particular sin. It's not a particular class of sins. The essence of paganism is just departure from God. It's departure from His known revealed will. That's why paganism comes in 1,000 forms. People depart from God in different ways. Some people, their departure from God is they just want rebelliousness and they want it in sex and drugs. That's why they go into the rock and roll culture. You will find people of the pagan spirit that are in the Wall Street world. They don't do rock and roll. All I listen to is classical music. They're moral. Oh, I'm a good Catholic. I'm still a virgin. They don't do the drugs. Never smoked. I never drank. Much less did I ever do cocaine. They're still a pagan. They don't know God. They don't love God. They don't love the Word of God. They have no interest in the things of God. Their only interest is in mammon. It's idolatry. It's covetousness. And they're just as pagan as that long-haired, tattooed, rock and roll druggie. Isn't that amazing? If you can't see that, if that doesn't make you tremble, you don't understand paganism. The spirit of paganism, Psalms 2:3. Let us break their bands and cast away their cords. The spirit of paganism is we're tired of letting God tell us how to live. We're tired of His standards. We're tired of Him holding us back so that we can't live the way we want to live. We're tired of Him saying, you can't do what you want to do. Let me take a little rabbit trail here. You have to understand this about God, or you'll never understand Him. The things that God prohibits believers from doing, what we call sins, not a single one of these things is prohibited on an arbitrary basis. God is not arbitrary. Everything that we're prohibited from, whether we understand why we're prohibited from it or not, is a prohibition that actually is focused and based on our own happiness and satisfaction and fulfillment. He knows better than we do what we need to be happy and fulfilled. Trust and obey. There's no better way to be happy in Jesus than trust and obey. Why do people rebel against God and go off in whether the Wall Street direction or in business and making money or off in the rock and roll rebellion cultures or any other direction? Why? They're looking for happiness and fulfillment. And they give themselves to it for years and decades. Their whole life. Some of them pretend that they have it. Most of them admit they don't have it. Now that's why the philosophers say, well, fulfillment and happiness, it's really in the journey. You know, it's really in the search. People spend their whole life seeking to find something. They finally get it, and when they get it, they're not happy. Now they've got to have a new goal, a new purpose. You know what? You get on the God path, that's over. He is so big, so infinite, you'll never exhaust it. Luke 19:4, we will not have this man reign over us. This is the heart of paganism. And this resistance to the bands and cords of God, the throwing them off, this refusal to let God be the king of our life, this always issues in the breaches of the fundamental institutions of God. I want you, in your conception of paganism, to back away from looking at a few particular outward superficial things and to come down to some basic fundamental principles. The basic institutions of God are things like the distinction between the sexes, marriage, family, and the home. Wherever paganism comes, these things are assaulted and marred, overthrown, destroyed. Another one of the institutions of God is the Bible. The Bible only is the Word of God. Israel is the earthly people of God. The church is the heavenly people of God. Truth. There's such a thing as absolute truth. Wherever paganism goes, absolute truth goes out the window. If absolute truth has gone out the window, you are dealing with paganism. Doesn't matter if it comes from Harvard or Princeton or it comes from a man wearing feathers, covered in funny dust and paint, mumbling over a fire and incense. It's the same. Doesn't matter if it comes from a scientist or a philosopher or a theologian. If soon as they say there's no such thing as absolute truth, truth is relative, that is the pagan spirit. Truth is absolute, it's objective, it's propositional. We got paganism creeping into the church today through evangelicalism and Pentecostalism, where people believe that, well, that might be true for you, it's not true for me. Say what? No such thing. It's either true or it's not true. It's either the mind of God or it's not the mind of God. It's either God's will or it's not God's will. It's either the Word of God or it's not the Word of God. There's no true for me and not true for you. Now, maybe people apply things a little different, but we're going to still have to give account to God for how we apply the truth. I might apply it one way, George might apply it another way. But when we stand before the living God and we give account for our life, there was one truth. Maybe he applied it better than I did. Maybe I applied it better than he did. Maybe we both had our heads screwed on backwards and somebody else got it right. But there's one truth. It's propositional. One of the biggest problems of modern evangelicalism today is there's a lot to talk about Jesus. Oh, we just love Jesus. I watched an interview one time with a prostitute who, before they were going to go out for the day and do their work, they all held hands and prayed to Jesus. Jesus, bless this day, help us to make money. Say, what? The fact of the matter is, just because people use the name Jesus doesn't mean a thing. The Jesus of the Roman Catholic Church is not the same Jesus as the Jesus of the Bible. The Jesus of the modern evangelicals, the modern Pentecostals, is not the same thing as the Jesus of the Bible. There are real believers in the Catholic Church. There's real believers in every evangelical and Pentecostal group. But that does not mean that those movements are going in the right way in and of themselves. Propositional truth means this is... Let me give you an example. Jesus is Jehovah God. That's either true or false. Jesus is born of a virgin. It's either true or false. If you cannot falsify something, it's not truth. Now, that you got to understand. When I'm saying truth is proposition, you can put it in a proposition, and that proposition can either be verified or falsified. If it's true, you're going to verify it. And it's absolutely true. But if you have a proposition someone makes and it can't be validated or invalidated, it's error. It's error. How do you deal with this modern Jesus? Well, you know, we don't want to get all hung up in the details. People want to argue over whether Jesus could have sinned or Jesus couldn't have sinned, and Jesus Son of God or Jesus is not the Son of God, and you have to believe in the blood atonement or not believe in the blood atonement. But we just love Jesus and we know God sent him down here to do us good. You can't invalidate or validate that Jesus. You can't prove that Jesus is true or false. He's just nebulous. The Jesus of the Bible, the one that died for us on the cross, he can be validated by propositional truth. He was born of a virgin. He's the eternal Son of God. He is God manifest in flesh. He rose again on the third day. He is coming back to judge this world. And everybody that will not bow the knee to this Jesus is going to be cast in hell, no exceptions. Propositional truth. These are facts. When people move away from that and they want to get nebulous, they want to get gray, they want to get subjective instead of objective, they are on the path of paganism, even if they keep evangelical forms. And this is where modern evangelicalism is. I've had young believers sending me emails frustrated with evangelical circles they're in because their churches and their Bible colleges are starting to talk about, you know, we need to re-examine this homosexual issue. Or we need to re-examine, you know, what the Bible means by fornication and where we're going to draw the lines. Because maybe we've been too strict. And, oh, we need to re-examine the ecumenical movement. And maybe we need to just be more receptive to different ways of coming to Christianity, like Mormonism and Catholicism and blah, blah, blah. This is gray. This is relative. This is subjective. This is no clear lines. This is no propositional truth. It means it's a lie. It's a smokescreen. This is wishy-washy. This is paganism. This is Babylon. The real issue of paganism, it's like a twofold coin. On one side, when we're just looking at the essence of paganism, when people reject God and the known will of God, they start breaking all the fundamental institutions of God. They're not going to be held by God's moral standards. They're not going to be held by His definition of marriage. They're not going to be held by His views on sexuality. They're not going to be held by His views on a lot of issues. They're going to depart from that. They're going to reject the church, reject Israel, reject the Bible, reject salvation by faith. They're going to reject it. So they break this stuff. But there's another side of this coin. It's even more terrifying than that side. When man cast aside God's bands and cords. He says we're not going to be limited by God. It effaces the image of God that God has impressed on man. It damages it, destroys it. We are made in the image of God. Because man is made in the image of God, we are a rational being. We are designed to act rationally. We are designed to search for light, to pursue light, to submit to light when we find it. We are designed to deal with facts and truth and logic and reason and evidence. This is what we're designed for. In Romans 12, 1 and 2, we read about that our service to God is reasonable. It's logical. It's rational. Our walk with God, our fellowship with God, our service of God, our worship of God is worth no more than the amount of truth and logic and reason that's attached to it. God is not into emotions and feelings if they're not attached to truth. If you have truth, then you put all the emotion into it you want. But emotion in and of itself is nothing. Fun and exciting meetings, great, if they're attached to truth. If they're not attached to truth, they're worthless. We're designed to be rational. But when men resist light, they're resisting what they know is right. They're walking away from it. They're rebelling from it. They are not acting rationally. When men act irrational, when they resist light, when they don't pursue light, when they walk away from light, we descend from where we're intended to be, which is a being, an amazing being, fearfully and wonderfully made in the image of God. We descend from that down into the animal realm. We become like animals. This is why the Bible uses figures like dogs and goats and hogs and wolves for unbelievers. Every one of these creatures has the ability to be noble, but they also have great abilities to be dirty, filthy, vile, savage, treacherous. You constantly read in the national news about someone says, I can't believe my dog bit that kid and sent him to the hospital. He's never bit anybody. I've had him for 12 years. Well, he tore him up, sent him to the hospital. Dogs do that. Wolves are worse. We have to make our decisions based on light. We have to be rational. And when we don't, we descend into animal likeness. And this we see all over the history of the world. Nazi Germany, the Iron Curtain, the Bamboo Curtain, the Russian pogroms before the Iron Curtain. Everywhere you look in history, the Catholic Church for centuries in the Middle Ages, bloody, brutal, vicious, like animals. This is what you have in the concrete jungle. This is what you have on Wall Street with cutthroat business practices. This is what you have in the corporate world when people will do anything to climb the ladder. They'll trample on their morals, they'll be mean, they'll lie, they'll deceive, they'll cheat, they'll misrepresent the people under them and over them. This is animalness. This is not being in the image of God. This is the image of God being crushed and abused and trashed and defiled. You might as well just say, I don't want to serve you, God. I just want to go out and live like an animal. Because that's what we're doing. When we get in the New Testament, we see believers living this way. We read about, in one verse, biting and devouring each other. We're not living like people created in the image of God. If we're biting and devouring each other all the time, we're just like a pack of wild wolves. We're living in the animal realm. We're not living in the divine realm. God help us. So the two sides of paganism, one is it's just trashing the institutions of God, and the other side is it trashes the image of God that we're made in. And we become less like God and more like an animal. And this is why in John, when we read that when the world sees the church walking in love, they know that we're the Lord's disciples. Everywhere the world looks, they look in the business world, they look in the political world, they look in the religious world, they look in anywhere they look in the world, they see people on the animal plane. Even when you see some nobility, it's mixed with viciousness. It's mixed with animal traits. Biting and devouring and fighting. Trying to be the top dog. Trying to be the cock of the rock. Trying to be the king of the hill. Trying to be number one. And you look at the church when the church is walking the way she ought to walk. With the image of Christ being formed in her. The individuals, the local churches, the broader way. We're not walking in the animal plane. We're walking on this higher plane where we're manifesting the image of God that we're created in. And we're walking in love that doesn't act like animals. With tenderness and kindness and compassion and grace and mercy that you never see in the world. And light and truth. It just seems so funny that some evangelicals get all caught up about truth and they just kind of get wishy-washy on the love and the grace and the mercy and the kindness. And then you see evangelicals that get all worked up about love and grace and mercy at the expense of the truth. You don't have to compromise either side of this equation. You can be in a master in truth and have light and truth and doctrinal soundness and be in dead earnest about it. And at the same time, be in dead earnest about love and grace and mercy. These things don't have to be contradictory. They're only contradictory if you're influenced by a pagan spirit. Either the pagan spirit that wants to trash the truth of sound doctrine, or a pagan spirit that wants to trash the truth of living like God instead of like animals. I want to not just live like God instead of animals. I want to think like God instead of animals. I got a heart and a brain. I want truth and light. And I want love and kindness and tenderness. And I want to hang around people like that. I'm tired of hanging around Christians that are all truth and no heart, or they're all sappy love and no truth. When I hear that rapture trumpet blow, I want to go up holding hands with people that got a good heart and a good mind. I want to have so many people hanging on to me of the right kind that it's hard to even go up in the rapture. God's got to crank that thing up a little harder. But when there's this deep depravity. I'm going to have to kick it into high gear. We're going to go late, but we're going to only go about 5 more minutes. This deep depravity of man is what's behind judgment. When I read about God flooding the whole world and 8 people were left, I shudder. When I read about fire coming down from heaven and turning Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities of the plain into ash, I shudder. When I read about Israel coming in the land of the Canaanites and the Lord had them slay without mercy the entire Canaanite race. Now, they weren't faithful to it, to their commission. But that's what they were to do. Nobody's be left alive. Not even women, not even children, not even infants. And that just seems like, wow. That's a heavy, heavy thought. It's stunning. But the fact of the matter is, the only reason for such severe dealings with paganism is that this is paganism that has sunk its roots in all the way. This is paganism as black as it gets. When paganism gets that black, you have to absolutely remove it from the scene, or godliness cannot even grow. This is like deal with gangrene. If your leg is gangrenous, it's not going to be fixed by a little alcohol and a Band-Aid and a kiss from mommy on your boo-boo. You got to cut that leg off. This is how God deals with paganism. He waits until it comes to its full expression. He's a tender and compassionate God. This is why when Israel was going to go in the land, the Lord made Israel wander in the wilderness for 40 years. Why? The iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. But when the iniquity of the Amorites was full, and they were so far gone, they could not be converted, and any believing testimony in their midst would have been put to death, and they'd be gone, they'd be exterminated. When this happens, God has to deal. And so not only does God deal this way at the moments in history like the flood and Sodom and Gomorrah and Israel coming into the land and at the second coming. He's dealt with this similar to this in smaller ways in history. Where there's certain points of history and historians wonder, why did things just turn around at this point in history? It's because God's in control and He's going to make sure that the testimony of godliness is able to survive to do its job in this world. I'm going to race through a few examples of paganism, and then we're going to call it quits for this message. We got sexual sin all around us. And it used to be the evangelicals were sound on this. Today, evangelicals are going wishy-washy on sexual sin. They're starting to say, well, this isn't sexual sin, and maybe it's a little dangerous, getting a little too intimate, but this isn't really what the Bible's talking about. It's talking about fornication. And this isn't fornication over here. And pretty soon you can pretty much do about everything and not be a fornicator. That's bad. That's paganism. Classic idolatry is making a comeback. People are going back to Druidism. And we may not be sacrificing our children to an idol, but when people get an abortion, they're sacrificing their children to the gods of this world. Not only that, just like they used to pass their children through the fire, figurative sacrifice, you can give your children over to this world system. Dedicate them to the world. A lot of people do. I want to cover very briefly those things that I mentioned, like the trimming of the corner of the beard, tattoos. It's easy to understand why sexual sin, we can't go there. Easy to understand why sacrifice to children, we can't go there. It's not so easy sometimes for evangelicals to understand, okay, why has the Bible got a ban on tattoos and trimming the corners of the beards and things like this? Tattoos were banned. I'm not going to give you the verse. I'm going to make you look it up. I'm going to make you study. But it's just simply a ban on marking the skin. Doesn't really tell us why. I think we have to read between the lines. It's really just it's against nature. If God wanted you to have a tattoo, you've been born with one. I got a tattoo when I was in the army, before I got saved. Or at least before I got my eyes opened by the Scriptures. I was a babe in the Lord. I've been reading my Bible in dead earnest for a couple months. I've been reading in the Old Testament. And I came across that about not having a mark on your body. I got a little tattoo up here on my shoulder. I pulled out my big army knife. Very hardened steel. It's able to cut through a steel grain bin. And I was going to cut that baby off. I didn't want to have that thing on my arm. And my roommate pleaded with me. He said, brother, it's going to come off in the rapture. Don't worry about it. Just repent and go on. But it's a sin against, it's just simply a sin against nature. There's not necessarily any religious connotations in there, though there is sometimes. The ban on earrings is the same thing. It's just based on
basic nature. Women dress one way, men dress another way. It's a distinction of the sexes. And it's just an assumption. The Bible doesn't have any passage that just comes out and plainly teaches this boom, boom, boom. It just, as you read through the Bible, you begin to realize it just has these assumptions. Can a maiden forget her adornments? Doesn't say that about men. Does it say, can a man forget his adornments? Doesn't say that. It's just basic on nature. When we come to the ban on trimming the corner of the beard, this trimming of the corner of the beard, you ever seen those pictures of the Egyptian gods that they had this little straight beard that comes down off their chin? In the Canaanite religion, in the Egyptian religion, in the Norse religions, in the ancient Phoenician religions, they're all related. They all were interacting with each other. Their god wore that little beard that came straight down. He trimmed the corners of his beard. If you were wearing a beard like that, you were emulating the religion and the religiousness and the god of the heathen religion. That command had religious significance. And the mixing of the woolen and linen, which was practiced by the Celts, was practiced by the Norse, it was practiced by the Phoenicians, and it was practiced by the Canaanites. This also had religious significance. It was similar to Cain offering the fruits of the earth on the altar. They intentionally mixed the linen with the woolen so that you had the fruits of the earth in there. Same error that Cain had. It had religious significance. In and of itself, is it any big deal? I mean, wearing a pair of wool pants with polyester in it? I mean, for us, there's no religious significance in that. But if there was religious significance, if people wore polyester and wool together for a religious signification, I'm not going to wear a mixture of polyester and wool. So two of these were based on nature. If it's based on nature, it's just as true today as it was then. The things that are based on religious signification, it's based on, you can't, we can't get our religious practices from the world, and we can't emulate them. And now also, these things, it's not like there's just four issues and that's it. If you're discerning and you're thinking, you look and you say, well, if these things are against nature, maybe other things are against nature too. The discerning man can see there's principles behind these things. They're not banned on an arbitrary basis. And the same with the religious things. If the trimming of the beard had religious significance and that's why it's banned, the mixing of the wool and linen had religious significance and that's why it's banned, then the discerning man looks back and he sees things with religious significance. Nobody does religious things without religious significance. I don't know what the Catholic Church does today since Vatican II, but for centuries they mixed water and with the wine. Had religious significance. People wear certain cuts of clothes for significance in religion. Just have a little discernment. These are not the only two things that are wrong, but it gives us principles to start thinking and let the wheels turn so that we can look at the stuff in the world that has religious significance, and we don't go there. We follow the Bible, we don't follow man.